From just inside storage room 3B at the Republican National Committee, this is Doublespeak. On today's program, former congressman and current candidate for Tom DeLay's seat down in Sugar Land, Texas. Now, yeehaw and hold on to your cowboy hats. We're sitting down with Nick Lampson, a man who helped draw the roadmap that created the blogosphere and whose blog gets over 100,000 hits a day. Once known only as Atrios, today we unmask Duncan Black. And finally, his impersonation of Senator Chuck Schumer makes me want to nosh up some brisket and spin the Hanukkah dreidel. Newspaper and blog contributor, Ari Melber. So charge your hybrid,
talk about your feelings,
and burn your bra, because it's time for Doublespeak with your hosts, Matthew and Peter Slutsky. Come on in. This is Doublespeak. Hey, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Welcome back to you, too.
It's our second episode. Wow, we haven't been canceled yet, Peter. That's
In
pretty
fact,
good.
We've been renewed.
We've been renewed for a third?
A third show.
Well, pop the champagne. Let's do it. You know, one of the things we want to do during the show, and we want to make our listeners aware of all the different ads that are happening out there.
Very important.
It's very important to know that some ads they're fair, and they kind of highlight what the candidate's all about.
Fact
some
check.
Ads, not fair. Here's one that we dug up from recently that we don't consider fair. These people are way out on the left bank of politics.
So this is a progressive ad.
This is the Democratic left-leaning side hitting the Republicans
right,
pretty hard.
Let's take a look.
All right, Josh, bring it up on Channel 1.
George W. Bush and George H.W. Bush had you believing you knew everything about Harriet Myers. But did you? We don't think so. Harriet Myers' resume has a gaping hole. From 1991 to 1995, Ms. Myers went on tour with the ladies of the Lilith Fair, including the Inuo Girls, Sarah McLachlan, and even Jewel. American values? Are you here? Nope. Go to www.whereweryouharriet.org to learn more about Harriet Myers and those missing years on tour.
Paid for by MoveOn.org, George Soros, Planned Parenthood, and the New York Times.
Ooh, that was dirty.
I think I need a shower after that one.
Well, you also don't smell great anyway, so you might want to consider taking one.
Small studio. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our interview with Nick Lampson, who's running against Tom DeLay down in Sugar Land, Texas. Perhaps no one stands for the corruption and abuse of power in Congress more than Representative DeLay. He was forced out of his leadership position after being indicted for criminal conspiracy, and his political future hangs in the balance.
Tom DeLay has spent his career in Congress, orchestrating and conducting the Republican majority, and has ruled that world with an iron fist. His fall from grace signals the beginning of the end of GOP domination, and if there are two people that worry him most in the world, it's his future cellmate and life partner Jimbo of the Texas correctional system, and our guest Nick Lampson, the Democrat running as his opponent in 2006.
Lampson was a congressman from 1996 to 2004 and was redistricted out by an effort led by none other than Tom DeLay. Today, he's not bitter about the past, but he's focused on the future.
We know what the current political climate inside the Beltway is surrounding Mr. DeLay, but can you tell our listeners what's happening and what's on the minds of the voters in your district, aside from scandal and indictment, and on what types of issues are at their forefront?
Well, you know, you can't turn away, and I'm not doing this effort to run against Tom DeLay, but you can't ignore what has become a part of his record. His record has been significantly about making his personal power grab, if you will, increase his personal power and the power of his party and his own finances. I came here with the intention of trying to work together with people. I heard the stories told of old by members of Congress who would say we would fight all day long with people from both sides of the aisle, and then we'd go drink whiskey and play cards in the evening with them, and we didn't care whether they were Democrats or Republicans. We were friends. I thought that's what it was going to be. Maybe it was a little naive on my part to think that was the case that could be in Congress when I came up here. The issues that are important in the district are not too terribly different from the rest of this country. People are very much concerned about our economy and about our budget. They are angry over the fact that we are passing on to our children and grandchildren and future generations unbelievable debt of $8 trillion our deficit, which continues to grow. And we hear comments from people like Tom DeLay who say that, well, there is no more fat in the budget, that we've taken all of that out, and we've got to borrow more money to do these things that we're doing. And then you have his own party come back and say, that's nonsense. And it is nonsense. We've got to prioritize our spending much better to make sure that we address the problems of border security and homeland security and access to health care in this nation, which are of critical importance. And I want desperately to make sure that we keep Social Security, because Social Security made a difference to me in my life. My father died when I was 12 years old. That was the year that I went to work sweeping floors in an elementary school. But if it hadn't been for my community through Social Security giving my mother $19 a month as long as I was a student, we wouldn't have been able to stay together. My mother didn't have an education. She had went to the fifth grade, and she had six kids to take care of. Literally, our family could not have stayed together. We gave back tremendously more to our country than what we ever took from it, and that's the purpose of that program, and it's helped untold numbers of people.
You're going to have a lot of political cover from the National Party, and your race will certainly be a bellwether for their efforts. What message do you want to see party leaders and other members of people running for Congress and members of Congress running? What issues do you want to see them focus on in this upcoming election cycle?
We can't continue to see all of the resources of this nation go into a war that is not bringing fruit for us. I think that is of critical importance, and we need to be told what the future holds for this thing. And I've already mentioned about the health care, but it is atrocious that we have 45 or 50 million of our citizens who don't have access to health care. It has everything to do with how we will be able to be a producing nation into the future if we can't keep our population healthy and accessible. And if we don't address the situation that we face with energy in this country, our gasoline prices are putting a damper on the economy now. We know that other developing nations like China are going to reach a point where their consumption of fuel in this nation is going to take away our ability for the future. If we don't begin to look to our future and do the research necessary to develop alternatives to what we have been what we've been blessed with for the last 100 years, then we're wrong. We are just out of touch with the reality of this earth. I want to see us put the kind of emphasis on education that causes us to create sparks in kids' eyes like what we had in the 60s during the Apollo years, so that kids wanted to go study math and science and engineering and the kinds of things that caused us to be the technologically advanced nation that we were. That's where our focus ought to be, and that's what I want mine to be for the coming years as I serve in Congress.
Can you talk about what your campaign is doing online to reach out to blogs and, you know, your website and this community?
Well, we've got a couple of diaries that are out within the area. I don't know how much I can say about these on yours or not, but we certainly want people to go to my website, which is www.lampson.com, L-A-M-P-S-O-N, and find out about me. Know the kinds of effort that we're making to entice people to join our campaign, to know that people, even though they don't live in the 22nd Congressional District of Texas, can still make a difference by helping us reach out to those people. There are many things that folks can do from outside of our immediate area. Yes, this is a campaign that will have national importance. Yes, if we change this race, we change the politics of America. We take the first step to getting control again of this nation and doing things for our children and for future generations, and that's critically important to me. We're going to have a different kind of campaign on the ground there. It's going to be something that, in my mind, is more like a caucus than like a traditional campaign. And it's going to take the involvement of people at that grassroots level, in or outside of District 22. People can come there and help me knock on doors. They can help me organize house parties. They can call or email their friends in the district. They can help me raise the finances that are so critically important to be able to get the message out to the folks within the 22nd Congressional District. But what I need is people to realize that through these media, through the efforts that you're making, we can change this whole political system.
Yes, we can, and we want to thank Nick Lamson for doing his part. Until 2004, Duncan Black was known to his readers only as Atrios, an alias that he says is actually a misspelled reference to a character named Antrios in the play Art by Yasmina Reza. Duncan's website, atrios.blogspot.com, has been remarkably successful, logging over 100,000 hits per day from his loyal and enthusiastic readers, qualifying it as the third most trafficked blog in the political blogosphere. We spoke with Duncan in Philadelphia, where he now lives. On a picturesque Saturday morning, we strolled through historic Rittenhouse Square and discussed politics, the FEC, upcoming elections, and the evolution of his blog. First, what inspired you to start blogging, and are you surprised at the personal success that you've had on the blog, and are you an internet celebrity?
Well, as for the first question, I mean, the primary motivation for starting a blog was simply that it was a bit more healthy than yelling at the television set and a bit less annoying to my wife, I hoped at least. But the second reason was that I did see that there was this emerging new medium, which, unlike a lot of the other things going on the internet, was starting to have an influence on other portions of the news media. I'd seen that people like Glenn Reynolds of Instapundit and some other bloggers were being quoted by Howard Kurtz in the Washington Post, and, you know, that there was this medium which was starting to have a small effect, not a big one, but at that time a small one, and it was a very, very conservative medium at the time, and I thought, well, you know, I didn't want yet another new medium to be taken over by conservatives, so I figured I'd be the liberal, and so I became the liberal. As for being an internet celebrity, I don't, you know, when you have to explain what you're famous for, it's you're not that famous, really.
I guess in certain circles, right?
In certain circles, yes. But if, you know, people point to a famous blogger, you have to actually explain just what blogging is to most people. So it's
We're finding that with this show. Yeah. For most of your online career, you wrote anonymously.
Right.
And do you feel you'd reached a point where your anonymity undermined your credibility? And was that part of the reason why you decided to go public and drop the alias in 2004?
Yeah, well, I think that the anonymity always undermined the credibility a little bit, and in a way which, I mean, I didn't mind so much. That was never a big concern of mine. I always understood that, you know, to the extent that you're going to have an impact on other parts of the media, some anonymous guy in the internet is not going to get quoted all that often, and I understood that. But the real reason I stopped the anonymity was mostly just because it became unsustainable eventually. That is, you know, how can you sustain a website that's sort of that much traffic and that much attention while sort of trying to be anonymous? And enough people started to know who I was that, you know, it was going to come out eventually. But I mean, basically my career sort of changed. I left my job, and that, you know, freed me up to be, you know, to reveal myself to the world.
What are some of the blogs that you rely on?
The blogs I rely on are blogs like Pandagon, The Daily Kos, The American Prospect blog, Tapped, Matthew Iglesias. My favorite blogs are actually the funnier blogs, the people who, you know, monitor and make fun of the right wing so I don't have to. People like T-Bog, World of Crap, The Poor Man, etc.
There's certainly a lot of them out there.
Yes.
There's been a lot of talk about federal legislation dealing with internet communications, and recently especially. There's been a number of bills debated, and it's easy to get mixed up on how each bill would change the current laws.
My basic position is, in my ideal world, is that blogs would, to a great degree, fall simply under the media exemption. I mean, my basic point is I want to have the same freedom that Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, The Washington Post, The New York Times, Al Franken, Slate Magazine, Salon, that these online media institutions have. I don't want any more freedom to operate than they have, but as they are considered to be media, they're essentially exempted from all FEC regulation. I'm sympathetic to members of Congress who are worried about certain aspects of campaign finance law, specifically that it would open up a coordination loophole, allow, you know, I understand those concerns, and I think those concerns can be addressed within that same basic framework, but basically a blanket exemption to me is better than the alternative.
I want to ask you a question about 2006, because that's a lot of activity on the blogs and discussion focuses on that at this point. You currently live in Philadelphia and in a state that will be among the most important in 2006. The race between Santorum and Bob Casey is already starting to heat up, and how do you see this race evolving, and are you concerned at all that, although Casey seems to be in good position a year out, the Republicans, as of late, have shown remarkable ability to close strong and kind of finish with a win?
I do worry. I would like to say that there is actually a primary in the Pennsylvania Senate race, and I don't want to ignore the other potential candidates, Chuck Pinocchio and Alan Sandels. But, you know, assuming that the presumptive winner of that primary, Bob Casey Jr., is the winner, I do worry. I mean, I think that the problem with Bob Casey Jr. is that it makes it very difficult to attack Santorum on what I see to be his weaknesses, even in a, you know, kind of a state like Pennsylvania, which is blue, but not extremely blue. It's a swing state. You know, I think Santorum has weaknesses on the abortion issue and other related issues, stem cell issue. And the way to win Pennsylvania statewide is to win the suburban Philadelphia counties. And then those counties have a lot of pro-choice Republicans in them. And, you know, we have two not pro-choice candidates running, and so Bob Casey Jr. is going to have to figure out how to appeal to those pro-choice Republicans and independents who live in those counties and convince them that he's a better alternative than Santorum. I mean, Democrats are fortunate that Santorum has been very good at shooting himself in the foot in the last year or so, and so that's to our advantage, but we can't just rely on, you know, the other guy being weak.
The mainstream media has settled on this perception that Democrats lack backbone. We hear it all the time, and we hear it on the Sunday show as we read in the paper. Which Democratic candidates and current elected officials are you excited about? And which ones do you think could break this detrimental notion of the Democrats that the media has, the mainstream media seems to have?
In terms of elected officials, I think Senator Reid has done a great job. I think he's pretty crafty about how he deals with things. He's probably not the most media savvy of all people, but he knows how to work the political process more behind the scenes, and I think he's been great along those lines. I think that's something Democrats need to understand, that, you know, the media is not on their side. The media is in opposition, and too often Democrats treat the media as if they're on their side, or at least, you know, they're a good friend who they can win over to their argument if only they try, and that's just not the case. And I think the Democrats, I'm kind of answering the opposite of your question, but the Democrats who make the most, the biggest mistakes are the ones who think that the media is their audience, the ones who think that, you know, Tim Russert and Chris Matthews and Bob Schieffer and, you know, the various panels on the Sunday television shows and the other talk shows, that's the audience that they're trying to appeal to. I mean, we appeal a lot, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, appealing to, you know, normal average Americans. Well, whatever Tim Russert and Chris Matthews are, they're not representative of normal average Americans, and they are not who you need to appeal to.
What are the issues that you and your readers, and in talking to, interacting with your readers, want to see Democrats focusing on? If you were sitting down with Democratic leaders today instead of in a park with us, what would you tell them to talk about in 2006?
You know, I mean, I hate to go back to the 90s cliche, but to a great degree, it is the economy. But then what does that mean? I think, you know, we're not a poor country, but I think a lot of people who aren't actually poor feel poor, and that's because
So do you see the economy as being a bigger issue than the war, which is obviously on people's minds?
I mean, the economy is the issue which is always there, while the war is an issue which is there right now. I think Democrats, and I think they're starting to understand this, is that they need to understand the war isn't going away. And I think they spent too long just kind of assuming it was going to be over or get better or go away as an issue, and one that they could run away from and one that they could not cope with. I think now they're understanding that one way or another they need to address it. One way or another they need to understand this is a problem. It's not going away. The leadership of George Bush isn't going to make it go away. I think in large part because Bush himself has defined losing as leaving. that is, you know, he set up sort of a frame where if we pull out troops, that means we've lost, because, you know, we haven't defined what victory means in any sense. And so, you know, as long as Bush is in power, we're going to be in Iraq, and you know, we're not going to be even starting the process of leaving, even, you know, through 08, let alone 06.
We want to thank you for sitting down with us, or standing here with us today on Doublespeak. And
you're welcome.
And we really appreciate all that you're doing, and hope you continue to do it.
Thank you very much.
And now, a think piece with Ari Melber.
Senator John McCain is waging a high-profile fight with President Bush over the administration's torture policy. America desperately needs leaders like McCain to challenge Bush's reckless and failed foreign policy, and the media has dutifully reported on McCain's confrontation of his former campaign rival. But look closer, and you will find a very different McCain. The 2008 presidential hopeful has been discreetly but vigorously working to prove his conservative Bush credentials to right-wing activists. McCain remembers that his 2000 campaign went down in flames when he ran as a sharp alternative to the left of George Bush. His popularity in the rest of America could not help him. Radical conservative activists shut him down in preseason. McCain won't make that mistake again. Now he's trying to run as the closest thing to George Bush. This is the Bushification of John McCain, and it is awkward. This summer, he told the Arizona Daily Star about his newfound support for teaching creationism, which many evangelicals are now calling intelligent design. That's a big change from 2000, when McCain declared it was an issue for local school boards and found himself outflanked by Bush. The 2000 Bush campaign, of course, said creationism, quote, ought to be taught. McCain may hope that 2005 reversal will be old news by 2008, but the Daily Star's headline blared, McCain sounds like presidential hopeful. In September, he delivered a whopper by caving on a key disagreement with Bush, tax cuts. As the costs of Hurricane Katrina mounted, McCain went on national television and told Chris Matthews the Bush tax cuts must be maintained. But McCain voted against those tax cuts. In fact, he was one of only two Republicans to oppose Bush's signature 2001 tax cut. Given the surging costs of Katrina, Iraq, and Medicare, there's no policy rationale for reversing his position now. The only rationale is political pandering. McCain should stop pandering to the radical right if he wants to hold the center. That's why I think the Bushification strategy is doomed to fail. You cannot posture a firm ideology for political advantage. You either have one, or you don't. And Americans can tell.
Better,
I'm Ari Melber.
Safer,
for
freer place. He deserves not only our support, but our admiration. That's why I am honored to introduce to you the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
That's all the time we have for today, friends. Join us next time for an interview with former boxer and current Democratic Senate Minority Leader, Harry Reid.
Mr. President, you're trying to give the American people some facts that do not exist. The whole war is based on a false premise.
We'd like to thank our guests today, Congressman Nick Lampson and his staff, Duncan Black, also known as Atrios, and Mr. Ari Melber.
As always, we want to thank the Doublespeak team, our producer and senior tattoo advisor, Joshua B. Scaroff, the woman in whose womb we floated, our mother, Phyllis Slutsky, resident actress and all-around babe, Whitney A. Estrin, our moneymaker, Shake What Your Mama Gave Y'all, Sarah Sheridan McAndrew, Key Grip and Best Boy, documentarians Lauren Feeney and Cameron Hickey, attack ad guru Noah B. Scaroff, senior counselor Maxwell Walrath, logistics coordinator Mike Heck of a Job Brownie, choir director Sir Elton John, and of course our listeners. You are our four favorite people on earth. Visit Doublespeak online at doublespeakshow.com, and remember, please vote like my brother.
Please vote like my brother.